John Ashbridge, longtime CKNW employee with a few little quirks along the way. You started very early into this business, about a year before I did, 1960, it says on your bio here. How did you first become interested in becoming a broadcaster?
I have vague recollections of being in kindergarten in Ontario at the tender age of 4 or 5, and somehow constructing what I perceived to be a microphone on a stand from the building blocks. I think that's sort of the earliest genesis of the whole thing, if that's not redundant. And frankly, I never really gave it another serious thought until I was in high school, when I had by then moved to Victoria and started hanging around CJVI and later on CFAX. And I guess I was taken by the lack of heavy lifting involved in a career of that nature. And of course, I'm a somewhat slightly built, people have used the word shrimp and wimp, that's fine, of stature. So I just felt that this was something that this looked like a lot of fun. I could do this, and frankly, never really gave it a serious thought until I guess late in high school, when I'd been making a general nuisance of myself at CJVI, following them around to all their remote broadcasts, and later to CFAX, where they, being a daytime-only 1,000-watt radio station with, I believe we had 2 paid commercials per day. 2 per day. And this was, and they were both by the federal government, believe it or not, part of a make-work program, I believe. And so they had, I mean, they had very little in the way of income coming in, and they had very few staff. Mind you, if you're only on the air from 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon during the winter, you don't need a lot of staff. And here I was, a high school student who was, I suppose, eager to do things, eager to learn things, and was also eager to work for no money at all. And as a result, I caught on there. And at about the time I was going to graduate from high school, BCIT opened its doors, and the first class went in 1964, and that was the year that I got out of high school. And I looked at the curriculum and made the bold decision, when I was all of 17 years of age, that, being a teenager, of course, I knew everything anyway, that I would spend the first year learning a lot of what I already thought I knew. And so I instead opted to come over to Vancouver and shop around for a job, and managed to secure one a month and a half before I got out of high school. And there's a whole story behind that. So as it turned out, a year down the road, I was at CKNW, and I would still have been in my second year at BCIT. So I think I made the right choice. Again, you know, being 17, 18 years old, you can't tell me anything. I already have all the knowledge that's possible for any person to amass. Specifically, of course, about broadcasting. And that's when the great learning really began, when I went to NW.
Can you recall who hired you at CJVI?
Nobody really hired me. I got to know a number of the staff, and I learned the people who would tolerate me, and there were very few. But I learned what management, program director, station manager, news director, I knew what they looked like, and I stayed out of their way and, you know, picked my spots and tried to stay in the background.
Were you doing a show then?
No, gosh, no. Oh, no. I was sort of a helper outer with, you know, with the engineers, or a helper outer with the talent, a gopher. We would go out and do Sunday afternoon remotes at a particular drive-in or gas station, where you would have a live audience of none, and I would sit in the mobile studio and where we played the records. Boy, this goes back a long way. And you know, try not to wriggle around too much so as not to disturb the tone arm from tracking across the vinyl disc. And, you know, occasionally run inside with coffee, or, you know, just things like that. I mean, you know, get to know the people, get to know what performance is all about.
When was the voice first heard on radio?
The voice actually was first heard on radio at CFAX, when I would be working a weekend shift, or actually 2 shifts. And I do have a distinct recollection of I was an operator. Everything was voice tracked on the weekends, and it was a classical music station at the time. A good music station at the time. So it did play. CFAX did play a measured amount of classical music, and in fact, there was a 2 or 3 hour presentation of opera, which the intros and extras were voice tracked on reel to reel tape, and the albums were played. From vinyl, from a large box of London label.
Full frequency, full range recording.
FFRR, indeed, and almost bordering on hi-fi. and extended play as well. And the only thing that had to be done live, because in those days there wasn't really a requirement that you had to do a minimum amount of news or spoken word or other information programming, there was an insert for the weather that was sponsored by the almost unpronounceable Miss Frith Millinery. And here I am, a 16-year-old kid who was, with some trepidation, nervous about going on the air, and the inserts within the little jingle that had to be played, had to be timed, of course, to fit the recording that was being played, and it was one of those singing, the time is, and you'd have to give the time, the temperature is, you'd have to give the temperature, the humidity is, and we get all this stuff from the weather office. So I can recall that was, I think, a fairly good test, first of all, to be able to pronounce the name of the sponsor, Miss Frith Millinery, and then secondly, to get all of the numbers in the right order and insert them into this tape recording that was being played. A bit of a challenge.
So that was the first time that you spoke live on the radio?
I guess so.
And then what happened after that? We're in about 62 to 64.
Yeah, here. Somewhere in there. And as I said, I came over to Vancouver probably sensing that there wouldn't be a great deal of job opportunity for me, whether or not I had ingratiated myself or even pissed off the people at CJVI and CFAX, whom I'd come to know and love, and not necessarily that was reciprocated over the preceding years. I was just that annoying high school kid with, you know, the binder under his arm and zits all over his face. And so I came over to Vancouver, and because I felt that it was a bigger market, and knocked on a few doors, and I got a hearing from Jerry Gawne, G-A-W-N-E, late of Penticton, who was the, and formerly at CKNW, who was then the program director at CJOR in the basement of the Grosvenor Hotel, or as Frosty refers to it, theater under the stairs. I did an audition, read a newscast. This would be on a Saturday afternoon, because after all, I'm still in school, and Jerry said, I've got an opening coming up in the newsroom at the end of this month, and this month being March. And I said, gee, you know, I wouldn't be able to start. I'm still in school. And he said, oh, you're in university, are you? And I said, actually, no, I'm still in high school, sir. How old are you? Anyway, I'm 17, sir. But he did. I mean, God bless him. He held the job open for me to the end of June. As it turned out, a colleague and very good friend who had worked at CFAX in Victoria had moved over to CJOR in Vancouver, the late George Finstad, who passed away just a couple of years ago in Montreal, and who went on later to a wonderful career with the CBC. George had been working at CJOR, and I think he may have put in the good word, you know, that, you know, he's a good kid and he'll work hard and blah, blah, blah. And as it turned out, I didn't know, but George was about to leave at the end of June, or at the end of, I think his was the job that was coming open, and by the time I got to Vancouver at the end of June, 3 days out of high school, a second person had quit. So I had, in fact, inherited two jobs, boiled into one, and there wasn't a lot of money coming into CJOR in those days either. And I wound up working a seven-day week. I wound up working 10 hours a day from 2 p.m. till midnight, Monday through Saturday, and 10 till 6 on Sunday. And I did it largely of my own choosing, child labor laws notwithstanding. And I think it was for the princely sum of $250 a month.
Was this doing news?
Doing news.
For the whole...
Strictly doing news. There was myself. Our news director was the late Mike Halloran, who passed away just in the last couple of years, and Bob Gillingham, who died, 10, 15 years ago, I guess. And we were I guess we were the newsroom, and a young fellow who came from very good stock, Peter Kent, now a member of Parliament and former national broadcast host. Peter had just his father was the, I believe, editor of the Calgary Herald at the time, and I'm the one who sat Peter down and said, "Okay, this is how a control board works," and gave him his first grounding in radio. So.
Okay, so CJOR, then it says you stayed there about a year.
10 months.
10 months?
10 months. I started there a couple of days before the end of June 1964, and the seven-day-week job was starting to get to me a little bit.
I would think so.
Yeah, and the $250, I think I may have managed to get them up to $300, maybe $275. But I was later working at CJOR in the later months, I guess the early months of 1965, I would have been working out on the beat and ran into, associated with, worked alongside, competed against CKNW's outside staff, who included George Garrett, Carl Ways, Bruce Hood. Mark Raines had left NW and had gone to CJOR, and I worked with Mark at CJOR. And the call went out from Hal Davis at CKNW that he was looking for a summer replacement. By tradition, out of necessity, NW usually hired somebody to fill in over the course of summer, doing news, doing on-air stuff. And I guess I credit or blame Bruce Hood, who has since left the industry, for saying to Hal, "Well, there's this kid at CJOR that, you know, seems to know what he's doing." I had him fooled too. And I'd also had some experience doing music programming as a general announcer. And so Hal invited me to come out to New Westminster and talked to me, auditioned me, and said, "I think we could probably use you." And I think he said, I believe I was making $275 a month. And he said, "Well, we'd be able to offer you at least $300. So, I mean, that $25 a month raise, by golly. And I started at CKNW on the 10th of May of 1965.
Now, the studios at that time were?
227 Columbia Street in downtown New Westminster, a building that no longer exists because it's been
bludgeoned to make room for something else.
SkyTrain, as a matter of fact. And so I started there, and I started there doing on-air stints, I have done virtually all of the shifts as a reliever, not as a permanent occupant, but I started doing, the road show and Jack Cullen's Owl Prowl, and filled in for Ed Ferry doing the afternoon show, and later for Norm Groman. And doing, noon to three, and even I used to be Jack Webster's operator when Wally Garrett would be on holidays from 9 until noon, and even did breakfast one morning when Bob Hutton wasn't there, so.
What kind of music were they playing?
Oh, it was pop standards. It was, they were an M.O.R. Yeah. station with a reasonably heavy talk form. I mean, you had to remember that Pat Burns, of course, was still ruling something of the roost in the Vancouver market, and I worked alongside Pat reading news while Burns Hotline was on the air on CJOR, and then went to work, of course, for the enemy out in New Westminster, the big dog, as it was known. And after about... and I also filled in doing some news shifts, and I guess after the course of a few months, 6 months, 8 months, whatever. Obviously, I had managed to last longer than a summer replacement, and I suppose it was through attrition that there were holes that had opened up in the CKNW staffing. And I went to Hal and to Warren Barker and said, frankly, I feel more comfortable doing news. And Warren said, "Well, you've shown your qualifications." And the rest, as they say, basically is history.
So that stint at CKNW, according to my little cheat sheet here, lasted until 1967.
It actually lasted until 1966. I had three interesting, if ill-fated, months as the news director at CFUN. And here was an opportunity, and I took it strictly, I believe that I was making somewhere in the realm of $400-some-odd a month by 1966. Oh, I'll tell you, I was rocketing up the payroll. I think I took that job for about $600 a month. And Ed Ferry, as a matter of fact, who had worked at CKNW, was the program director at CFUN. And they were out of the rock and roll era. Well, I'm sorry, no, they were still in the rock and roll era, but they were looking to get out of that. They were moving more into MOR, and they wanted to do some talk things, and they wanted to beef up their newsroom, and here was a chance for a 20-year-old kid, to go and be a news director in a major market, and so I took it. And it did not turn out well, because behind the scenes, the owners who were Eastern-based, were in the process of divesting themselves of the station, and it was bought up by the Tiedemann family from Verdun, Laval, Quebec. They very quickly turned it into the all-news operation. This was after I had left, but this was their plan, and while it was a good plan, I think it was somewhat ahead of its time. And I was offered my old position back at CKNW, and so I went back there, and again, I think I went back there for, again, a substantial $25 or $50 a month raise in pay, and I had a young family by then, so this became important to me, and went back to NW and stayed there for the next 4 years, and around 1970, we saw the advent of competitive radio in smaller markets in British Columbia. And CHNL in Kamloops had been granted its license to compete with CFJC. And Ron East, who owned BVLD, CFBV, and CFLD in Smithers Burns Lake, had just been granted a license to open a station in Prince George to challenge CKPG. And Ron and Norm Wassine, whom I had gotten to know through network connections, Norm had suggested that I might be a candidate to become the news director at the news station in Prince George. And eventually I did take the job, stayed there 3 years, and then I had a marriage that was coming apart at the time. And, you always seek to move on. My wife, the mother of all my children, with whom I remain still good friends, at least that's my assessment, we'll have to ask. You'll have to interview her. She was a Victoria girl as well. If I can ever be accused of growing up, that's where I did it. She wanted to move back to the coast, and so I helped her move back to the coast, and I myself moved back to the coast and had remarried and stayed back at NW. Again, I was offered more fool NW for hiring me back all those times, after I walked out on them so many times. You know, frankly, they didn't owe me anything. I owed them a lot. And I came back and stayed at NW through the late 1970s. And it was a time of some expansion. It was a time of developing network operations. It was a time of getting play-by-play hockey, the Vancouver Canucks, and the BC Lions, securing the rights, exclusive rights to their broadcast. So NW was doing a lot of things, and NW was, very much ruling this market. They were a hugely successful radio station, and largely of their own effort.
Mm-hmm. And who were some of the people you were working with during that era?
Oh, boy. I worked for Hal Davis, who was the program director, and later on he went to become general manager, and I moved up to sort of the de facto program director's job. It turned out to be an almost untenable position. But I worked with, Warren Barker. I mean, if I can ever be accused of ever learning anything, I learned all of it from Warren. But John McKittrick and I worked side by side for, the better part of 20 years. And John still remains a good friend. Terry Spence, who went to work at CFAX, he followed Mel Cooper over to Victoria. I worked for Mel. Of course, Frosty Forrest was there. Wayne Cox was there at one time. Jack Cullen was still there. I got to know Jack reasonably well. Essentially, you name it. We were moving more and more into talk. So I've known Shirley Stalker since almost the day she came on board as the executive producer of talk radio, and we still have a number of connections you know, with all the volunteer things that we continue to do in the market.
A lot of great people.
A lot of great people, a lot of, you know, wonderful people, a lot of, you know, very close friends and people, frankly, with whom, you know, I'm happy to say that I've been able to stay in touch with those people. Frosty and I, Paul Preston, we trade emails on a regular basis. I must have had two or three from him today and sent him one or two, including, you know, notification of the passing of one of our former colleagues at NW. So, you know, it's an ongoing relationship.
That's great.
Yeah.
Let's talk about one of the little left turns you did in your career. You took off.
I went to Australia.
How did that come about?
Well, you know, it always seems to go back to the same thing. I had another marriage falling apart. I have wives scattered all over the globe, let's face it. I had another marriage coming apart. And at the time, I had sort of left NW's full-time employment in the late 70s because I had gone as far as I felt I could go. And I was you know, kind of banging my head against,
get to that rung on the ladder where there's all those people above you and until they die or leave or whatever.
Well, it wasn't that so much, although there was some of that. But I was sort of the de facto program director. And at the time, WIC and Chorus, at the time, WIC was going through some changes, some fundamental changes to the way it was structured. And Hal Davis had actually moved downtown to become a program director for the group. And as he moved downtown, a decision was made that they didn't really need a program director for the group. I was, in fact, programming under Hal's tutelage, under fairly tight control. I was responsible for, I guess, a lot of the grunt work in programming. I didn't do a lot of policy, but I did a lot of the paperwork for programming. And Hal then moved back to New Westminster, and so it was almost like a reverse domino effect that I wasn't going to go any further up the ladder because all of a sudden people who weren't there were back on the ladder ahead of me. And I had been doing a little bit of part-time teaching at BCIT, and an opening came up at Langara Community College in Vancouver, now part of the Vancouver Community College chain, to teach journalism and on a full-time basis. And it was specifically broadcast journalism, although there was some print journalism to be taught. And I decided that maybe what I would do is I would take a step back and I would go to work full-time in academia. And at the same time, I had incorporated, had a small company running, and had picked up the contract to do the weekend sports on CKNW. Big Al was responsible Monday through Friday, and my little production company was able to pay the likes of Randy Hahn, Jim Hewson, both of whom have gone on to wonderful full-time careers in the sports play-by-play business. They were a couple of employees, and I did part of the shift as well, and we did the sports morning, noon, and night on weekends and holidays for CKNW, and it gave legitimacy to my company and provided another loophole for not paying as much tax, although paying it at a higher rate, so, you know. And I did this for about a year, year and a half, and my sort of common law brother-in-law, he was the guy who lived with my wife's sister. Follow me so far?
Mm-hmm.
He worked for a little architectural firm in Vancouver. Now, in the architectural business, once every X number of years, a major architectural project comes up. At the time, the flavor of the year was the new Parliament House in Canberra, Australia. And there were 150 to 200 entries from around the globe, as I recall it, from qualified architectural firms who had this wonderful vision for what the new Parliament House in Canberra should look like. And what normally happens, as I'm told, is the list is whittled down to a half dozen. And lo and behold, this little tiny firm from down in the west end of Vancouver was one of the six finalists, which meant my de facto brother-in-law, Andy, had the opportunity to go to Australia for a year to refine the project, refine the drawings, and submit it to a final bid process. And I had, while working at Langara, done a little bit of overseas correspondent work for one of the stations in Sydney and their network of stations around Australia. And this suddenly became my last chance to run away from home. And I went to the Australian Consul General in Vancouver, armed with a letter from the people with whom I had been doing some work in Sydney, a letter that said, here are all the things I am qualified to do. Not that there was a job waiting for me, and not that there were all of these qualifications being required, but here are all the things that I could do. And the Consul General was very kind and said, well, you know, obviously you would be an asset of some sort to Australia, and you don't look as if you're going to suddenly go there and apply for welfare, and so we'll let you in. And so I landed in Australia sometime in March of 1980, and without a job, went knocking on doors and got myself a job within about a week, and was on air doing on-air news in radio at 2CH in Sydney, a station owned by the Catholic Church. Not that I'm Catholic. And that lasted for about 6 months or so, and I was encouraged to move into television to become the producer of 7 Sydney News, the nightly local news program on the 7 network station serving Sydney. And that became a little bit of an impossibility to manage, because if you understand Australia, most of the people in the country live in the capital cities, and most of the news in the country happens in the capital cities. And we did a half an hour of news followed by a half an hour of national news, which went all the way around the state. Well, if anything big happened in Sydney, I couldn't have the story on my Sydney news. We'd have to wait for the national news. We, you know, the producer of the national news and I used to sit across the desk and ponder the prospects of, now what happens when the 747 crashes into the Sydney Harbour Bridge? And I was expected to go on the air at 6 o'clock and pretend that everything was fine, and then at 6:30, exclusive footage of the 747 crashing into the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
That happened at 5 o'clock.
Exactly. Yeah. So it became a bit of a difficult job to do, and I found myself very quickly in a job working at 2SM in Sydney. I'm sorry, the 2CH was owned by the Council of Churches. That was the Protestant mafia. And I went to work for 2SM, which is owned by the Catholic Church. Good old rock and roll radio. And they had a great newsroom at the time. And I worked there for about 6 or 8 months. The thing you have to remember, too, about Australia in the 1980s, and it's true to a certain extent to this day, that it's very much a class structure, and it's very highly unionized. And for every A-class journalist, you must have 2 B-class journalists. And for every B-class journalist, you must have at least, or sorry, for every 2 B-class, you must have at least 3 C-class. And for every 4th C-class, you must have a cadet on staff. And so I knew that my progression up the ladder was going to be somewhat limited. Plus the fact that although I had the ability to both write and read, somebody with my accent, even though I was born in England and I am Canadian, my on-air accent or my speaking accent, my voice, I guess, was honed, refined, whatever phrase you wish to use, on the west coast of Canada. And so I have a tendency to have a little bit flatter, broader pronunciation of words, and I am easily mistaken for an American. The only thing that the Australians hate more than the Brits is the Americans. And so being on the air on a top-rated radio station in a city of 4 million, in a country that doesn't really like Americans, I could see that this was going to be somewhat career-limiting for me. And at about the time that I was starting to think, what do I do with my life now? And oh, by the way, the marriage that was folding up in Vancouver, from which I kind of ran away in hopes of patching it up, and my wife followed me to Australia, it turned out that it had come apart again. And so there was, you know, there wasn't a domestic reason. I'm telling you far more than you really need to know, but there wasn't a domestic reason to stay there. And lo and behold, a Mr. W. Barker of New Westminster was on the phone saying, had enough of working down under, and would you like to come back for the princely sum of? And I said, you don't have to pay me that much. And he said, well, you've been away for a while. That's what it now costs. And I said, well, if you're willing to pay me that much money, I'll be on the next bus. And so I came back, and I went back to CKNW on the 10th of August of 1981, and pretty largely stayed there until I left at the end of the broadcast fiscal year, at the end of August in 2005.
Now, when you went back, besides Warren Barker, who had been there for a very long time, who was still working in the newsroom and who was new?
Gosh, Gord McDonald was there. Well, Warren was the news director. We had not moved downtown. That's right. So
were you on McBride?
We're still on McBride, and I went back. The Rutherfords were the Dave was there. I think Doug came later. Jack Benest was there. George Garrett was still there. McKittrick was there.
Any women?
Doriana was there, Doriana Temelo, my current wife, to whom I have been married for better than a quarter of a century now.
Wow, this is a lasting one.
Oh, this one is going to last. I promise you that. I promise her that. Yvonne Emore joined us, actually, and I'd met Yvonne. I had met Yvonne at Langara, as a matter of fact. She was working for the journalism program at the time, and I got to know her before I went to Australia. And it was largely, both the prompting of Barker and my lovely bride, or bride-to-be at the time, I suppose, it was their encouragement that said, come back, and so I did.
And you moved up the ladder this time.
Moved up the ladder a bit, eventually becoming somewhat responsible for network operations and doing a variety of things, but largely involving news and network. And then we moved downtown to the downtown Vancouver studios in the...
TD Tower.
Mm-hmm. And I was responsible there for a measure of network operations and working in the newsroom. And in the time period that I was back, I got more involved with hockey. The opportunity to become the PA announcer for the Canucks opened up. So, there were some things that developed along the way. There's no shortage of new things that keep coming up, mm-hmm. happily.
Let's talk a little bit about the network thing, because you and CKNW were pioneers in starting a private satellite network. What year was that when the Western Information Network came into being, and how did all that happen?
I guess it all happened starting about 1970 when the Vancouver Canucks entered the NHL, and the prospect of putting together an NHL broadcast network reared its ugly head. At this time, I would have been in Prince George, but I'm not absolved of the blame because I was the news director, assistant manager of CJCI, and I was very hot on the idea of CJCI getting the rights to the NHL broadcast. I thought that would be a good thing for the station. And as a result, Hal Davis agreed that a way would be found to get the signal to Prince George. This was long before satellites were in vogue, so it would all be landline delivery. And we were doing a certain amount of networking anyway among the three second stations in the market, CI Prince George, NL Kamloops, and CKIQ in Kelowna. Plus the stations that we owned in Prince George, the stations in Smithers and Burns Lake. So we were trading news, information, programming, ideas back and forth on a fairly regular and sometimes live basis. And adding the hockey to it was just another step. Well, things grow. Then about that time, Canadian Contemporary
News Network,
yes.
Chum and Moffat,
and of course Standard Broadcast News. They were all seeking to enlarge their national footprints, and so networking was becoming something in vogue. The line that I like to use was British Columbia was the ideal place to try to establish a radio network because we have these lovely things called mountains, mm-hmm. and radio signals do not penetrate through the mountains, at least not very well, so that you could have radio stations that may have been fierce competitors separated by 100 miles, whose signals did not overlap, were not heard in each other's market, and as a network operator, I could deliver a signal to both of them. Conversely, it just didn't work as well in Alberta. Numerous were the times traveling with the BC Lions, I would, finish setting up the equipment in the McMahon Stadium in Calgary and have a few hours before the football game, and so I turned on the radio and listened to what was going on in Edmonton. So, there wasn't as much of a competitive, exclusive to the market, topographical exclusivity, if you will, anywhere else in the country except in BC, and that's why the proliferation, and that's why we see it today, where owners who own stations throughout the region provide common programming to them, yet the people in Dawson Creek don't know that the people in Revelstoke, I'm using a bad example, I know, and it may not be the correct one, but they don't know that the people in Revelstoke are hearing the very same programming, which in fact is originating from Terrace, let's say. Mm-hmm. You couldn't get away with that in many other parts of the country. So there was a great opportunity for networking, and there was also a great opportunity from a business standpoint. Sadly, CKNW's management didn't quite grasp that as vigorously as those of us who worked in the network side of things. Otherwise, it could have been bigger, could have been better, could have lasted for longer, but it was still a lot of fun doing it and met a lot of great people along the way.
A lot of great technological advances came from the CKNW engineering department, which was led by some pretty stellar people.
It was. You can go back to just some of the little things that I first learned, because I've never been, a qualified engineer. Unlike yourself, I can't take the back off a piece of malfunctioning equipment and diagnose what the problem is. I can, however, deliver it to you and say, it's doing this, but it's not doing this, and I suspect that the problem is in this area. And you probably would say, I think you're right. I think it's the whatchamacallit. Okay, you take the whatchamacallit out and find out that, in fact, it's not the whatchamacallit, but it's the thingamajig right next to it. Okay, I knew it was in that area, but you know specifically that that needs an R2150 to fix it. And they don't really make those anymore. So
You have to make one.
You have to make one, or you can get the one that supersedes it, which is the one, the R4150. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fine. I've always had, a bit of a respect, a bit of an interest in things technical, and... you look back at CKNW's engineering history. It's NW is just as much a pioneer in
building talent, equipment,
in building, and in
designing,
in inventing equipment. The Aristocart is probably the classic example that Don Kalmakoff had to find a way to run an automation system that would play a stereo cartridge, and so he took one apart and sat and studied and puzzled over it. And Jack Gordon, bless his late heart, he was just a wonderful engineer because, it's more than electronics. It's a case of who can find the way to make something happen. The equipment is incidental to it.
You're looking for a solution to a problem.
There we are. And if the solution doesn't exist off the shelf, then you make
something.
You create
it.
And people take a look and go, yeah, that, of course. That makes sense. That's what you needed, but nobody had built one of those things before. So I got to know a little bit about frequency expanders. I got to know a lot about uplinks and downlinks of satellites and, the various
automation
systems and that sort of thing. And in an era when there was still a lot of development going on. In today's era, a lot of it is so computer-based, and I think the advances in computer-based technology have slowed somewhat in that, you always think to yourself, well, I guess they've invented everything that can possibly be invented, and we've sort of reached kind of that point now in terms of what radio might need. But there are still, advances being made in video technology, so, that will continue to carry on.
Now, you decided to walk away from the whole thing in 2005, which would be basically 5 years before standard retirement age. What was the decision about?
It was actually six years before standard retirement age. I'd always said to myself, I'd always had fun doing what I was doing. If you're starting a job at $250 a month and you think a $25 a month raise or a $50 a month raise, you've, died and gone to heaven. I was never in it for the money. I was never in it for the money. I was never in it because it was going to make me famous. And I still don't think I'm famous. I mean,
well, I beg to differ.
Notorious, perhaps, but not. No, I'll go.
You're a very modest man.
I will go into a grocery store and I will, you know, salute the cashier or something and present my credit card, and the cashier, aren't you the guy who the hockey, and you know, my wife will look at me as if, you know, I can't take you anywhere, can I? But I mean, that's really the only claim to fame, but if there is any claim to fame. But I never got in it for the money. I never stayed in it for the money. I went where there was some adventure, there was some challenge, there was the fun. I'd like to do this. I want a piece of that. So I got out of the business on a full-time basis at about the time that I started to think to myself, you know, if you're going to be true to your principles, this isn't really fun anymore. This is a case of how much money can we send to Toronto every Friday afternoon? And, you know, you'd seen people come, you'd seen people go. There was an attempt. I won't say it was a valiant attempt. It was a well-thought-out attempt, and I think it was an attempt that should have been pursued to do all news radio.
I was going to ask you about the experiment.
At CKNW. Mm-hmm. And CKNW already had the established infrastructure. I think it could have been successful. It would have been successful, and perhaps more successful than other attempts at doing all news radio.
But it
radio
was strangled in the crib.
Well, it was strangled in the crib because I think Toronto was saying, we aren't getting enough money from you. So, and, you know, we were under new ownership at the time as well, and I believe, truthfully, that the powers that be have kind of backed off and said, well, you know, maybe these people who are running the operations for us in Edmonton, Calgary, Winnipeg, Vancouver, maybe they do know what they're doing in their local markets after all. But it's an educational process, and, you know, you gotta serve the shareholders. Mm-hmm. I understand that. I'll be the first one to say that, you know, unless you've got the money, don't even think about this wonderful idea, because it isn't going to run unless there is money to propel it.
Other interesting John Ashbridge things. You did a part in a movie.
I did. Talk about being typecast. They were shooting Miracle, which is the story of the 1980 Miracle on Ice, mm-hmm. the U.S. Olympic team. And it was being shot in Vancouver, or at least Vancouver was the hub for it. And about a year and a half prior to it, a call had gone out for an arena public address announcer. And I mean, I didn't, you know, I was not in showbiz in terms of movie showbiz, didn't have an agent, have since got one, didn't have an agent. And, you know, somebody had mentioned to me, hey, they need a PA announcer, you know, voiceover role, fine. And so I went and did the audition, and they said, well, you know, we'll add your name to the list. And I guess within a year, they called back and said, oh, yeah, would you like to be the announcer, the arena announcer? And I said, sure. You know, here's your chance to, you know, get a job in showbiz. So when they started shooting it, when it came time to shoot the portion of the movie in which I appear, it was at the Pacific Coliseum. The Pacific Coliseum was masquerading at the time as Madison Square Garden, and this was the final tune-up game prior to the Olympic tournament, in which the Americans got thoroughly walloped by the Russians by a score of 10-3. Anyway, I arrived the day, it was a two-day assignment. I arrived, and the director said, I want you to go to my trailer and sit down and look at the video from a documentary on the Miracle on Ice, because you're going to be doing the play-by-play. And I said, no, hang on, I was the arena announcer, the public director. Oh, no, you're doing the play-by-play. So all of a sudden I was propelled from being a background announcer to, if you appear on screen and you speak, you are a principal mm-hmm. actor. Yep. I have my own dressing room.
Wow. A star on the door?
Nope. but it had American announcer on the door, written on the gaffer tape, and it was one of the portable trailers. But no, I have a credit in the movie, and as a result of having a credit in the movie as a principal actor, I also am in the Hollywood database, and it's the one and only thing that I have done. But what it did then was kind of, you know, propelled me into this whole area of, gee, these people pay reasonably well, and you know, I mean, and it was a what I thought was a single buyout that I was given. Lo and behold, in the last couple of years, I've received a couple of very small checks of less than $200, but these are checks that have been generated because the movie has now shown up on cable and in other forms. So I'm in a movie.
The other thing that you are very well known for is the voice of the Canucks in GM Place. How did that come about?
That came about because John McComb of CKNW, and there's another name that somebody that we both, with whom we both worked and known for some time.
And admire.
And admire. I have a great deal of respect for John. John was doing the, John did the public address. A lot of people, you know, because I've been doing it now since 1987, so as we speak, give or take the years of strike and or lockout in the NHL, I've been doing it now for 23 years, and a lot of people think I've been doing it since 1970. No, I may look old, I may sound old, I may be old, but I'm not that old. No, Tom Peacock, another well-known name in the Vancouver broadcast market, the late Tom Peacock, he did the public address announcing for the Vancouver Canucks of the Western Hockey League and followed them into the NHL. And he did it for about the first 10 years or so. And then in the early 1980s, there was a succession of different people who did the job, among them Sterling Fox, Brian Arnold, Tom Jeffries, and then John McComb. And John, at the time, I went in 1986 to run CKNW's bureau down at Expo. And when Expo ended, we changed shifts, and John took my old shift of 2 to 10 p.m. in the newsroom, which meant that he would no longer be able to do the Vancouver Canucks. And I had done a couple of games for him as a backup, and the Canucks came to me and said, well, McComb's not available. You've done a couple of games. You know, do you want to pick up where he left off? And I said, well, sure, you know, I mean, try me and see if you like me. And 23 years later, I'm still doing it.
Before we get to a couple of other highlights, there are other things that you were involved in now and were involved in when you were at CKNW. One of the things that you have to be very proud of, I think, is the Amber Alerts.
Well, Amber Alert, I learned a lot from Amber Alert, or I learned a lot about Canada's National Police Force, without naming names, and I learned a lot about the mentality.
And bureaucracy.
Well, yeah, but it's more the military mentality, that if it's not their idea or if they don't control it, they frankly don't wish to deal with unsworn civilian members, no matter how honest, upstanding, well-intentioned they may be. And as a result, I'm still on the books as the secretary of the Amber Alert Society of British Columbia. My reason for getting involved in Amber Alert was because prior to that, of course, I was involved with Crime Stoppers, doing the Crime Stoppers.
That was the other one I was going to mention.
Mugshots, Crime of the Week, and since retiring, I have become a director of Metro Vancouver Crime Stoppers. I always felt it was a bit of a conflict for me to be speaking on their behalf and also working in the broadcasting business and being a director of things that we were relying on CKNW's good graces and kind offer and generosity
to distribute
airtime. So I mean, and they have been wonderful partners for the
Crime Stoppers.
And so even though Amber Alert pretty much has ceased to function in British Columbia, Crime Stoppers is a going concern. Mm-hmm. I am a director of the organization, still do their on-air material, and it does keep me busy, and it's a lot of fun.
You are also a board member of the Royal Columbian Hospital
Foundation.
I
am indeed. I live in New Westminster, Western Canada's oldest incorporated city, and I am a director of Royal Columbian Hospital Foundation. I am, in fact, the vice chair thereof, and I serve along with another well-known New Westminster named Belle Puri, who is a former CKNW employee who is now at CBC. She is the chair of Royal Columbian Hospital Foundation, and that is something that keeps me busy. I have been involved in a number of different functions with the Hospital Foundation, and you'll be hearing more. We're just coming up on because as New Westminster is Western Canada's oldest incorporated city, Royal Columbian Hospital is Western Canada's longest-serving, oldest private health, public health care facility. We're coming up on 150 years, so there'll be, we hope, a few fireworks to celebrate the 150th in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Couple of other things, back to the radio biz. Favorite moments, favorite people.
Oh, gosh.
Highlights.
Well, you know, you could almost pick any one of them. Political conventions that I have covered, helped to arrange the production thereof, ad-libbing your way around lengthy descriptions of evolving situations and listening back and going, my God, you know, that was almost like it was scripted. I guess, you know, favorite moments would also have to be associated with the Canucks and with, you know, with being there when hockey is going on, working the Olympics, you know.
I was going to mention that because I think you've probably now been heard by over several billion people as the award announcer in the stadium.
Yes.
And your voice was full, loud, and clear, being broadcast on television and radio around the world.
And
that must have been a highlight.
It really was. I mean, you know, when you think about the people from, you know, the Republic of Mesopotatoes who have sent, you know, one and only athlete to the Winter Games because they live in a subtropical climate, and lo and behold, their favored son has, you know, finished bronze and deserves to be recognized on the world stage. God help you if you don't get his pronunciation of his name right. So it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And you got to remember that, of course, the Winter Olympics are only half of what the real, or a third of what the original Summer Games are all about. So here was a chance to shine on the world stage, and to do it in your own hometown. I mean, that makes a huge difference. And to be, you know, to be the English language hockey announcer in Canada who gets to say the winning goal in the gold medal game, scored by number 87, Sidney Crosby, 7 minutes, 40 seconds into overtime. I mean, you know, all of that. You're in the record books.
That's like the peak.
I guess it is. You know, that and you know, a couple of the other behind-the-scenes awards that have been bestowed
on
me.
Let's talk about that, the RTNDA Lifetime Achievement Award in 2005. That has, I think, gone to maybe three people.
Of whom we know.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, it goes to five people each year. But George... I know Tom, Mark, and I.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, Mark is the latest recipient,
right,
locally. And that's one of the reasons why I was actually ready to retire at 58. But I knew that I was going to be receiving this Lifetime Achievement Award, and I held on for another year, frankly, because I didn't want to be accepting it as somebody who had already left the industry. Mm. I didn't wish to seem less than grateful in accepting the award. So that's one of the reasons why I decided that I would wait until the end of August of 2005 before retiring.
You've mentioned a lot of names during our talk here today. Very favorite people that you were mentored you, people you worked with, people you mentored who went on to bigger and better things and still are working, have passed on.
Oh, gosh.
Favorites?
Favorites, well, I suppose Warren Barker, I mean, for, you know, working alongside him and just learning what he did. John McKittrick, he and I, we share almost a parallel life, even though he is, as I keep reminding him, he's considerably older than I am. But our first kids were born within about 8 days of each other. And, you know, we worked side by side, you know, 5 days a week and socialized on a few occasions otherwise. Hal Davis, bless him. I mean, he, you know, decided he would take a, you know, chance on this kid. Dave Shearer, who was my, I guess, program director at CFAX in Victoria, who, I, on the one hand, turned a blind eye to my helping out, on the other hand, said, let me go ahead and do things. There have been any one of a number of different people, and I know that I'm forgetting people. people I have mentored, well, you know, I mean, I keep looking at all kinds of different students who have gone on to much bigger and much better things despite anything that I have tried to tell them, despite any lessons that I have given them. They probably had the smarts to go, well, okay, we'll do as he says and not as he does, or vice versa. You know, Jim Robson, I mean, I worked alongside Jim, J.P. McConnell. I was his producer for football for a few years and worked alongside J.P. And just, you know, a lot of wonderful people you meet over the course of a lifetime doing this. And, I mean, the people that I met during the Olympics, what a wonderful crew of people. Highly skilled, highly talented, all of them far more experienced than I, and far more talented than I when it comes to being able to convey things to a world standard rather than just the North American standard to which we are used. I mean, you have to learn a whole new way of doing things, and you have to learn, you know, how it's done in two languages, not one. Not that I was in any way proficient in French. I can barely speak English on a good day. So, you know, there have been far, far, far too many to mention. But, I mean, I have what I would consider to be friends in the broadcasting business and in the sports fraternity virtually anywhere in this province and overseas as well, as well as a number of very good friends back east with whom I, you know, have come in contact over the years of working in broadcasting and working in sports.
John Ashbridge, thank you very much. You're a very modest man.
Thank you.